Hi, this is Steve, and here are some more of my gaming vexes. So, so thanks for taking the time. Thanks for getting up in ridiculously early in the morning, Tristan.
Not at all.
So we're going to have a bit of a chat about Soulbound today. If you've listened to the podcast, you know the routine.
I'm Neil Benson. I suppose I do have to mention the shitter. It's at Old Scouser RPing. And on the Blue Sky, I'm Old Scouse RP is where it is on Blue Sky. Anyway, not that anybody cares. Nobody's going to type that in. And I'm something similar on Mastodon as well. So there you go.
Tristan Arbra, live in Japan, running a lot of campaigns at the moment. On Blue Sky now, as an alternative to X. At tristanarbro.vsky.social, whatever the address format is. And on Discord a bit as well.
With our aging brains, trying to remember multiple tags for difference, it's beyond me.
Hello, I'm Mark, as advertised. I am at B4GI on X, shitter, and Discord. I've never even heard of Blue Sky. I think I'm on Mastodon. I think I signed up when everyone else did, but it's probably the same on Mastodon. I'm out there somewhere.
That's all we can find if they need to. So we played through, it was a reasonable sort of series of Soulbound. Mark will know this. I get the sense that Mark probably is pretty much abreast of, you know, the GW things that have happened. Neil less so. Yeah, there. Look at all this. Look at that crap he's got in the hill behind him. There he is. Wow. Okay. I've got my.
Are you such a nerd, Mark?
I've got all my Allgate stuff down here and all my Sigma stuff. Anyway, whatever. So basically, and I don't know about you, Tristan. Are you pretty much across it as well? The whole history thing of it, or
I'm pretty out of date as far as it goes, because I was a first edition kind of person.
Oh, wow. Okay. Right. So that's well out of date. So basically, GW realized they weren't making any money off Fantasy Battle, and they were selling more paint than miniatures. So they decided to basically blow up the world. So that was back in 2014, 2015, the end times. Remember that? And then they, everyone went, oh, that's sad. Okay. And then they bought out Age of Sigmar, and everybody hated it. It was like massive. They were like, so there were videos of people setting fire to their dark elf armies on YouTube, which I don't see that's a problem because they'd already paid for it. So GW had the money. So anyway, but anyway, it evolved. So Age of Sigmar sort of, I think, coincided with a bit of a resurgence from Games Workshop in terms of just engaging in the community and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's gangbusters. I think so much now that GW in the top 100 FTSE companies or something. They're just mad. And over lockdown, they made ridiculous amounts of money. So Soulbound is the RPG that came out of, the Age of Sigmar. So we'll start with you, Mark, really. So what's your familiarity with the setting? Before we played, what was your knowledge of the setting?
I'm sort of a bit of a Warhammer Games Workshop fanboy, and I have been sort of since the 80s. It was
shame here. It's in a safe space. So.
It was kind of because of Warhammer that I got back into role-playing, because it was sort of, I'd drifted away from both role-playing and miniature gaming and painting and stuff like that. But I sort of occasionally sort of like, you know, hearing a Games Workshop store as I was walking past and sort of, you know, check out things on the net, and it was the sort of the kerfuffle around the sort of the death of the old world and this new game that was coming in. And I sort of was like, what have they done? Why have they done that? What have they done? It's like the best setting in the world ever. But I was sucked in by it, and I started buying miniatures and painting again. And I was looking for podcasts, Warhammer podcasts, when it was suddenly recommended this thing called the Grognard Files. And I was like, what's that? What's that? It's like role-playing games. Role-playing games. I remember role-playing games.
There's a ray of light, John, from
and that was it. And that was it. You know, thousands of pounds and hundreds of hardback books and boxes later, and here we all are. Yeah, I'm quite familiar with it because I paint miniatures and stuff, and I'm into the tabletop game, and I also read the Black Library novels as well. So I'm sort of fairly well versed in it all. So I was quite excited when they announced that they were bringing out the role playing game for it, because I thought. Because it was kind of at the time in the first edition of the tabletop game, there wasn't a lot of background to the Mortal Realms at that point. And it was kind of almost like there was like two armies on a sort of featureless plane just fighting each other. And it's like, how could you have possibly destroyed the old world for that? It's just like, it's crazy. It's like, there's nothing there. It's just epic battles. It was just like, it was just like a tabletop war game rather than sort of a setting. But then when the second edition of the tabletop game came out, they sort of realized they need to sort of like focus on, you know, what was everyone fighting for? Where were the humans in all this? And what's it like to live in the mortal realms?
People need an excuse to kill each other is what we're saying.
Yeah. and so I was looking forward to Soulbound because it would, I felt that sort of like Warhammer came alive through Woofrup. There was that really where you sort of like got to, you know, experience what it was like to live in the old world, and I was hoping it was going to do the same.
How horrible it was, frankly.
Yeah, and how horrible it was, and hoping that Soulbound was going to do the same thing again, and you'd get to explore all these things that you don't necessarily need miniatures for. And so it would sort of develop into this sort of character place that the old world became.
So I suspect that there's going to be a continuum here, and I think you're probably on one extreme. And let's go to someone who may be on the other extreme. Neil, what about your awareness?
Zero, really, I guess. I mean, you couldn't have been a gamer in the 80s without knowing about Warhammer and Games Workshop, of course. But I think the Warhammer thing largely passed me by. I don't know. I think it was initially because it was like a battle game, like a war game, you know, and I had relatively little interest in that.
To buy it at the time.
It's
expensive.
I thought that like the cover on the first edition box was really good, and you know, and I like the styling of it from the start. Really, I suppose I played Warhammer role playing game when I was at university in the early 90s. Played a bit of that. But I've only really kind of dabbled and, you know, I've played it a handful of times. So.
Yeah, we played Warhammer, Fantasy Roleplay. Obviously, we played like a sort of a mini campaign ourselves, didn't we?
That was great.
It was fun.
That was really good. So I do like, I think that set in the old world setting, as much as I know of it, is fantastic. Very flavorful and all the Germanic naming and so on and styling to it, I think is fantastic. But in terms of the new, I mean, a thing that always put me off was that you know, people talk about a chaos spiky death thing, you know, or, you know, orcs with a Z and stuff, orc boys with a Z and all that nonsense, you know, and I just all that stuff kind of put me off the whole. You know, that silly side of.
Well, orcs with a Z, that's the Warhammer 40,000.
Okay.
Actually, yeah. Glad that you jumped in there and corrected him.
So I know. I mean, relatively little, other than about Soulbound, other than you know what I've been told in like preparation for this game. I do remember it's I think it was UK Games Expo before. It must have been 2019, and they had this like massive, diorama, huge thing with loads of. Age of Sigmar miniatures on and stuff like that. It was absolutely beautifully painted, looked absolutely amazing. But that's it, really.
You came into it with like whatever.
Fair enough.
That's okay.
I mean, I thought it looked interesting, you know, and it definitely is. But I was bamboozled as an understatement in terms of the lore. But you know,
yeah, and we can perhaps reflect on how much you need to know about the lore. Next to nothing, really. So, Tristan, whereabouts do you fall sort of between the poles of Mark and his fanboyism and his studied disinterest?
Somewhere in between. I moved to the UK in the mid-80s, so I missed out on the golden era of White Dwarf, and Games Workshop was definitely working its way towards becoming a miniatures empire. At the time, we were moving away from role-playing games to box sets of miniature battle games. So it was all Space Marine and Dark Future and all those kind of games coming out.
Dark Future. There's a game.
I did have copies of the original tabletop Warhammer, and I bought first edition Warhammer as well. So I liked that world. So it's fun coming back to it and discovering that there's been lots of changes in the background and seeing how they made up an entirely new version of the prehistory. Fun, especially seeing all of the Realm of Chaos stuff turned into something completely different.
It's totally evolved, absolutely. So I think I'm probably sort of more towards your side of things, Mark, in as much as when Age of Sigmar came, when they were blown up the old world, I was never really interested in the fantasy battle side of things, because I just didn't like what they call rank and flank, like square base stuff. Whereas I always liked to play a lot Warhammer 40,000 because it was little round bases. And I said, if they produce a game, fantasy game, it's all on round bases, I'll give it a go. And so I sort of got in when it started, and I watched with bemusement the general wailing and gnashing of teeth on the internet, which was most entertaining to watch. I mean, Schadenfreude doesn't cover it really. It was brilliant to watch it all. PW tried to make it its own thing. So basically the setting of Soulbound. I mean, the Mortal Realms, which is the sort of the world of Age of Sigmar, is intentionally vast and could be anything really. And that, again, that's what they want. But Soulbound itself is much more focused in, and there's a lot of focus on the realm of fire, so Akshi, and also the realm of life, realm Byron. But the whole idea is that chaos came, sort of took over, Sigmar retreated into his city, and chaos almost took over. And just at the last minute, he launched forth with his Stormcast Eternals, essentially Space Marines, fantasy Space Marines. Of course, don't at me, Games Workshop. I don't care. That's what they are. All right. But
Sigmarines.
Sigmarines, let's call them that. And sort of fought back chaos, and essentially has got these beachheads in the mortal realms. Again, you know, chaos is there's lots of it everywhere, but it's almost got, like, for me, this sort of 28 days later type feel. We've got these areas of sort of control, if you like, or order, but then around it are seething armies of chaos and undead, and it's all going on at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a zeitgeist thing to have the threat of the world be so ramped up. You know, as you say, 28 days later, I think that's something that reflects the times, and maybe that's a zeitgeisty thing that they're achieving in the Age of Sigmar.
Well, you could argue that GW has always reflected the world around them, especially with, not least with, like, some of the human just dread and early fantasy role playing, that sort of thing. So I suppose, what's your feeling about the setting itself? I mean, say you've touched on it, Tristan. You came into it with a little bit of knowledge, but I think, you know, the aim of the box X we played through Soulbound, the starter set, the aim of that is to introduce you to the setting gradually. Did that come through in the game we played? Did you get more of a knowledge, or are you equally as bemused by it all at the end as you were at the beginning?
It's certainly trying to take the stylings of Games Workshop material into different directions. And I quite like the sort of fantasy nature of what they're doing with it. I can see elements from more heroic comic things, or from some of the trappings of D&D or Pathfinder in it as well. I think the sort of freedom and the lack of limitation that might have been in the old world are quite opened up.
Yeah, it's fair to say that the whole atmosphere of Age of Sigmar, as opposed to fantasy roleplay, is you're in a ditch and you're having a really sad time. Whereas in Age of Sigmar, you might be having a really sad time, but you're doing it with lots of style and lots of shiny armor and massive swords, or whatever your weapon of choice is, of guns and things. So it is much more high fantasy, heroic fantasy, that sort of thing.
I did find it largely overwhelming. I think I had to focus on certain things. So you the way it was set up in Foundry, it was really well organized, and I could, you know, get the bits and pieces of info I needed. But like for my character class, I was a Black Corsair. I don't know if I ever read just that, all the info. It's just way too much. And it goes into, you know, it does say a few things that are really useful and relevant. And then it goes into chaos of Zoing and what's his name of Zingbat and stuff like this. And all of a sudden you're kind of like, you know, yeah, okay. Like, it does feel like it's a game for people who are really into, you know, already invested something into that, the setting, whether it's, you know, through the Age of Sigmar, you know, is it skirmish game? I think it is, isn't it? Something like that.
Well, skirmish game, a few miniatures. You could have hundreds of miniatures.
Okay, so maybe not a skirmish game. But
at its heart, it was a skirmish game.
Yeah. And I think it's in, like, any game. I mean, I'm not one for, as a player, I'm playing a lot of games, so I don't have time to I like to try new games, and I don't have time to kind of read all the ins and outs and the rules, really. So I do. I am quite good at winging it, and you know, and
I noticed that.
Yeah, I say I'm good at it. I do it. I don't know if I'm good at it, but I did the visuals and the styling of it are quite appealing. But the actual detail is if you're not used to it, is a bit much. But you know, I think that, like, as we played it, you'd explain bits and pieces as we're going along anyway, and I thought that was really useful. And so I really got a sense of the setting and, you know, the challenges the characters were facing in the world itself. But it's so like grandiose, the world, and you know, everything, even though it's almost like a world in decline, everything's still massive and on such a huge scale.
Cities.
Yeah.
Massive airships.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that, you know, that came across really well. I thought, yeah, it was really exciting. And I know we're not talking about the system now, but I think the system made it very accessible as a game. I think it really helped with that. And so you just had to deal with the bits of the setting and the lore that were kind of relevant
to you
at that point.
I mean, I reflect on, so some games... So I'm preparing a game, Sky Realms of Druid, at the moment, okay? And so within that, there's an awful lot of setting in that, And I wonder whether, so somebody coming cold without having at least a knowledge of Sky Realms of Druid and what it's about would probably get, it's going to be limited what they get out of it. Whereas I think something like Age of Sigmar, or Soulbound rather, is... You're right, Mark. The world is massive, and they've tried to focus it down to make it a little bit more palatable. But I think there are so many straightforward fantasy tropes in Soulbound. Actually, if you want to get really into the setting, and I love all that stuff, you know, I mean, I'm miles away from what's currently happening in the world of Age of Sigmar because it's just too much. But I really enjoy the way it's depicted in Soulbound. But there's so many fantasy tropes that actually you got your orcs. You got your, you know, if you know a bit about chaos, if you've got an experience of fantasy roleplay or something like that, then, you know, there's baddies, there's zombies wandering around, you know, there's enough there. Actually, you don't need to know anything about the setting. You could just, as you say, you can take what you want from it. You can dip your toe in, or you can dive straight in. And that's my feeling. And I think it's quite clever, really. You know, it sort of caters for both audiences. And obviously that's what GW want is. You know, the broadest possible top of the funnel in that customer adoption thing. Get them in. So. Yeah.
Probably the main thing you need to know about going into any Warhammer game, whether it's the old world 40K, Age Sigmar, is probably about the Chaos Gods. That's probably the thing that makes it slightly different to your regular standard, you know, D&D. It's got the elves and dwarves, Dwarden and elves.
And Caradhron. Don't forget you get the Caradhron.
But I think the thing you probably need to get a handle on, which is probably fairly simple, is the Chaos Gods and the way they influence them, what the four Chaos Gods, you know, do, and what their, you know, remit is and kind of stuff, and what they're trying to achieve. But yeah, I think like you say, it's, everything else is pretty much, if you've played a fantasy tropes, you'll be quite at home.
Yeah. So like the setting, I think it's, I really like it, and I think, as you say, you don't have, as long as you enjoy gaming, then I think you could probably give this a go. Actually, I think, you know, if you know a bit about orcs, you know a bit about, you know, if you want to know about Chaos Gods, you say, Mark, you can get into it. So we played through the Soulbound starter set, and there's like a mini campaign, if you like, within that called Faltering Light. That's meant to be something that it's It's described as something where you can pick it up and you can start playing, and actually it tells you a lot of what you need. If you're running the game, it makes it very simple to say, this is what you do, this is how you do it. And so as someone who's run a lot of games, I probably didn't get the benefit of that. But from your perspective, what do you think, and again, we played it on Foundry, so we had a lot of the support. I mean, we had the official modules on Foundry, so there's a lot of that stuff in there. What were your thoughts about the Faltering Light, the scenarios we played?
That was the first one, was it?
So we played two bits. So yeah. So the Solvang starter set has got Faltering Light, which is the bit where you went under the city and sort of looking for trying to open the realm gate, etc. And then we played sort of a couple of follow-on sessions, because the idea is it's got these what they call threats, so like scenario seeds. And that was one where I threw you in afterwards and essentially just threw into the meat grinder for fun to see what would happen. So let's talk about in two halves. Let's talk about the Faltering Light, the first bit. What did you think of that?
I sort of questioned who is this aimed at? Who is this being marketed to? I've got a very, very strong sense that it was for people transitioning in from D&D because of the inclusion of a dungeon in it. From my knowledge of Age of Sigmar, a dungeon is not the first thing I would think of to sort of showcase the mortal realms, really. I mean, they're obviously in there, but it was essentially a dungeon call. There was a bit of role play, a bit of city action, and then a sort of quite a lengthy combat orientated dungeon crawl, which is, you know, essentially it's Dungeons and Dragons, isn't it? But with you know, sprinkling of chaos gods on top.
But I think that's I mean, they're not stupid. They're like loads of people.
Clearly not.
Yeah, it's Cubicle 7 that designed it, but GW will have oversight over the whole thing, and they know lots of people play D&D. Yeah. And I think it's actually, for me, it's quite a clever choice, in as much as you got this massive world and let's really focus it down. Let's constrain it as much as possible so people have got something to do. But I think obviously it's designed for new players. But for ourselves, what did we think? Obviously, experienced role players, what did we think of it?
I really enjoyed it. I wasn't sure at first, but it actually struck me as, so I get what you're saying there, Mark, about it, you know, being a dungeon and so on, but it didn't feel to me like fifth edition when I played fifth edition. It felt more old school, really. I assumed that the dungeon was kind of randomly generated. I had the impression there was an element of that. And there were kind of rules for the dungeon crawl itself. Like you could retreat and, you know, there were various things you could do, consequences and so on, but it felt very old school to me. And I love that, you know, coming to an encounter, coming into a room, you have so much information, and then it's like, what are you going to do? Of course, you can have that in fifth edition, but it just felt more old school, particularly when we got into some of the encounters, which were really like, there were times there when I thought we were all goners, you know, one or more of us. I think perhaps apart from Mark's character, Grim, I think he's the only one who didn't get battered at any point. Or maybe Howard's new character as well, Krell, maybe. I think he might have been. But you know, it certainly felt it was a tough world, and the encounters were tough. You know, not all of them. Some of them, were good fun. And they were all good fun. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed that dungeon crawling aspect to it. And, you know, a sense of like discovering, because all the rooms we went into were quite different, and they told you something about the world as well. I thought, you know, some of the weird creatures and we were encountering. And it also taught you bits about the rules as well. So some creatures were able to do certain things, had certain abilities, and
rend your armor, which I know.
Rend your armor. That was a curse and a half. That was
a distress.
Yeah. Yeah. I had no armor for most of the adventure. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's node based, basically. Yeah. And as you say, there are rules for sort of moving between the various nodes. So it is pretty freeform. But yeah, and the way it's set out in the, as the GM, it's set out really well, I think, in the box itself. And there's loads. I mean, you know, the GM advice is it does spoon feed you, really, which is good because I needed it. But as I say, it's set up so that you do learn something new each time.
I really like the way the
Stormcast Eternals and all of the functions in the city were introduced through the NPCs at the beginning, and then how various different factions in the dungeon crawl came out as well. So you meet the whole variety of different worlds that are at play in the game through the scenario. That was quite well done. So the world building was pretty decent in that first scenario.
I liked it. And then we sort of did that one bit, and then we sort of I thought, let's extend it a little bit. Let's take one of these essentially one page scenarios, really. And so the idea is that in the game, basically, you've still got these sort of rumors that sort of flowing around. And you, as the GM, you can pick some of these rumors, and then after every session or every scenario, the clock ticks and they become more pressing. And so I chose one where you are on sort of convoy protection duty, and you get smashed up by this Maw Crusher, basically like a big Wyverny type thing, and then have to try and work your way out of it. And I just thought, how far can we push this? Let's see how much. And I think we got about four sessions worth out of that one pager. And yeah, and I pretty much played it as written, with the exception of, so I just put blocks of, I like clocks in things, that sort of thing. So we'll put those things in there. What were your thoughts about that element of it? Because it was, the idea was escalating threat with, hordes of the cornate, blood-craved worshippers coming to smash your faces in.
We could all see the glee on your face as, we wiped out one wave and you set, another wave twice the size of the last one onto us, just to see, how we would do it. It's kind of quite fun because in any other game, this just sort of shows you sort of the power level that the characters are at. If you threw what essentially are, beginning characters, first level characters, if you like, if you threw that much stuff, we were fighting demons, we were like hordes of things, and there were some like touch and go moments for some of the characters, but we just laid them to waste. My experience of playing, because I played a one shot once before we started the campaign, and I was amazed by the power that the characters had in just like dealing out damage left, right, and center. And I kind of got the same sense with this. I mean, certainly with my character, I was playing a character on Sky Warden,
dwarf dude with a gun.
Yeah, basically, yes, floaty dwarf with a ray gun, basically. Laid waste every time he rolled dice. But I think that, again, I think the different archetypes, which are the character classes essentially, I don't know how balanced they are in terms of their fragility and stuff, because
I don't think balance is a concern. Let's be honest, I don't think they spend I don't think they've got a spreadsheet like which is the coast a rumor to have where they balance everything. I think they just went, yeah, that's cool. Although you were laying waste, as you said, Neil, characters, we'll come to this in a second when we talk about rules and stuff, but there was threat, there was jeopardy, because we had one character die, definitely. We had another character, was that the one who got turned into a beast man? Was that something else? That was another one, wasn't it? I think we lost two characters, didn't we?
Yeah, because I ended up having to shoot one of the characters after they turned into a...
That's right. So the opponents are actually pretty tough. So I think even if you just charged in, you can't rely on your hit points or your toughness in this game, because, even Howard, who had a second character, was an absolute combat monster. He was laid out several times and on the verge of potentially dying. And I think what happened was they got this thing called soulbound points, and is it soulbound? Soulfire, that's it, yeah. Which essentially they're like hero points you can use, but again, that's a very limited resource, and so you can't be sort of throwing those around left, right, and center. So yeah, it was interesting. I'll talk a bit more about it later, about I prefer it to D&D 5th edition, let's say, in terms of that. So what about your thoughts, Neil and Tristan, in terms of that sort of second, this is a bit when you were fighting off the hordes of chaos?
If I go first, I'll be a bit briefer because I missed two of the sessions in the middle. So before the major escalation, I was off on business trips and hadn't missed that bit. So I saw the beginning of the escalation and the escape from the surface with the airship. It was great fun. I enjoyed the parts that I could attend. And having lots of stuff thrown at you and still surviving seems to be quite a general trope in this game. The heroic nature of the play is quite a lot of fun. It's really different dynamic to quite a few role-playing games I've tried, where you've got such heavy-powered characters. And maybe one of the things I like most in the recovery part was that you don't have to sit there for days recovering a hit point at a time. It's like once one combat's over, you just get back to normal and that's it.
Yeah,
that was a really sensible move.
Yeah. Potentially. I mean, you do. So you have your toughness, which is sort of like your hit points, and those go down. But once those go down, and you don't start with loads, 8, 9, 6, 7, 8, something like that. So it's not huge. But then once you get down to zero toughness, then you start taking wounds, and wounds are more difficult to heal. You know, it takes a couple of days to get wounds back. So it's not massive. But if you're under pressure, then it can cause issues. What about your thoughts, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I'd say I think if that was a one page, encounter, however it was set up, thought, yeah, you got a lot of mileage out of that because I wouldn't have guessed that. It was, I thought it was really well done. It was like the world opened up a bit more, we'd been under the city, and now we were heading out into the wastes. Like from the moment that what was it called?
It's like a more crusher.
That's it. Yeah, more crusher landed. That was a tough battle. Yeah, and then down to our decisions about what we were going to do in terms of getting ourselves out of that situation. You know, the ship had crashed and there was this threat. There were these Cornites coming in, and as you say, they were on a timer, and we had to build up a certain amount of like momentum, I guess, so that we could, either kill the, because there was a mummy maw crusher as well, wasn't it? It was really pissed at us because of what we did.
Even bigger than the one you'd fought
previously. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, we could deal with that, and we needed to repair the ship. We needed to deal with these waves of demons attacking us, and so I thought it was, it was really interesting. You know, there was, I don't know, it wasn't really resource management, but it was certainly making decisions.
Yeah.
And then of course that kind of led to the climax. I get Mark's points about, balance, and I've never been particularly a fan of balance. I think what worked in Grimm's favor was not only was he like a highly armed military helicopter strike copter or something like that. Like a
floating tank.
But he was
Airwolf.
He could fly. He was Airwolf.
Airwolf with a beard.
With a brass beard. I mean, I don't know how much it was a factor, but you certainly remember in the dungeon there was a lot of, how high is the ceiling, because that, and you could get out of reach of melee attacks, and then you had your weapons were often ranged weapons. I mean, thankfully, it was great that we had your nice, but, then if you look at Howard's first character, he was some kind of thief, sneaky character,
Howard does excel in choosing the most vulnerable characters in any.
He does, I've witnessed that in my games, but I think, then you get to, it seems to me it's a very action oriented kind of game, fight and stuff like that. It doesn't strike me as, like, I suppose if you look at a game like D&D, people say, D&D can't do everything, but it can do a lot of things. You can have wilderness adventures, you can have dungeons, you can have city adventures and investigations, and you're going to, burgling some of these houses and stuff like that. And I think when you've got that range of adventures, then the balance isn't such a big deal, because characters have their own points where they can shine. But because it is quite heavily combat focused, I think that's where you do notice the balance or the imbalance more, I guess. Yeah. Where would anyone's character shine? I mean, I thought my character was, I felt it was quite balanced for the the encounters we had, because they you know, they could do some real damage in combat, but they could also, you know, as they were battered quite badly from time to time, you know. And even Tristan's character Hal was a mage, I believe, you know, had some very powerful spells, but again, if he got caught out. But Grim was just like, you know, just blowing explosions everywhere, blowing everything up.
With his minigun.
You know, and but, you know, all that aside, it was great fun, though. It was great fun.
It was good fun.
And it was fast moving as well, which I really appreciate. I thought you know, we got through a lot of combats and none of them dragged the orders.
No, it's relatively quick, isn't it? So, certainly the way it's set up is a lot of combat in there. So, as you said, Tris, there's a little bit of social interaction, understand the world, a little bit of interaction in the dungeon. So, with what did we call him in the end? Leonard Arcival?
Ronald Arcival.
We couldn't remember what his name was. Anyway, he became this character this year. He became Ronald Arcival. It was this like snivelling type. So there's a bit of that going, you know, you're dragging him around as well. But I think in the game itself, the core book, it gives you it's all about options, really. So there are no character classes, such you can have archetypes, which give you a certain set of talents and attributes. So it's pretty quick to create a character. But you've also got the option to start with like almost like a zero level character. So you could play, you know, so the setup with Soulbound is that you are bound to the soul of Sigmar. So you're essentially like an avatar of Sigmar. So you're pretty tough and you're meant to be. But you could play it, and there's room to play it, where you're just a human or an elf or one of the, you know, the free peoples in a city. And so you're a lot more vulnerable then. And I think that would be a really interesting way of doing it, where you are, you know, sort of at the bottom of the ladder and investigation and a bit of, you know, even in that situation, just a chaos beastie is a massive threat, because you don't get all the bells and whistles that the rest of you get. So I think there's mileage in various play styles. So let's touch on rules, because obviously time's moving on. So the system itself, so Cubicle 7 do, I think it's four GW-based role-playing games. They've got Wrath and Glory, which is the Warhammer 40,000 one. They've got Soulbound, which is Age of Sigmar. They've got Fantasy Roleplay, which is obviously the Old World, and they've got Imperium Maledictum, which is like another Warhammer 40,000 one, but it's percentile based. They've got a different system for every game. None of this house system for them. They just do different things, okay? So the way this works, it's, again, it comes from Age of Sigmar, the skirmish game. It's all D6 based. And the idea is you compare how good your character is to your opponent. If you're much better, then you need to get a lower dice roll on a D6. So if you're the best versus the worst, you just need to roll ones, okay, or twos rather. Likewise, if you're playing against someone who's really good, you need to get sixes. And then, so that's what they call the difficulty. And you're basically creating dice pools. And then you have this thing called complexity. So some things require 4 successes, 5 successes, whatever it is. So that's really the core mechanic. What were your thoughts about the rule set itself?
I really enjoyed it. The thing I enjoyed most, and wondered this is probably a deliberate choice, the tabletop battle game is famous for having buckets of dice. Every time you do something, you know, you literally need a bucket of it. And, you know, there were moments in the game we were playing, I think Tristan was like throwing 14 dice on the table. It was glorious. It just seemed very, very Warhammer. I really enjoyed it. And Neil said, the combats were very, very quick. I think that's one of the strengths of the system is, you know, if you can have combat heavy game, please God, let it be quick.
Not again for Dark Matter level of complexity.
I really enjoyed it. It's quite intuitive once you get your head into it. I think it's quite easy to pick up. I've always had a problem with VTTs because they do so much for you in sort of like trying to actually understand. I'm not sure that I could sit down at a table and play a game and know the rules, having, you know, played on the VTT. But
I think the Foundry setup. So as often there's the free system, and then there's the, you can buy the paid for modules, which sort of add the extra bells and whistles. For me, it's a bit of a sweet spot. So it's just enough automation, but not too much. Yeah, I think you're right in as much as you probably couldn't sit down and play at a table afterwards, but it gives you enough. And so obviously we talked about the dice rules, where the dice mechanic works, but what you then have as well is talents. So like, which are basically like feats in D&D, which give you different things, like, you know, ambidextrous or, you know, obviously spellcasting or whatever it might be, but they're not massively unwieldy. Some of them you have to read a few times. Oh, I'm not sure how ambidextrous. How did that? I know we had lots of conversations here about ambidextrous. I've got two weapons. How did this work? Whatever. But once you got it, it was relatively straightforward.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. It was simple enough in terms of how you determined your dice. So for regular skills, it was based on one of your attributes. You only had two attributes? Was it two or three
attributes? There were three attributes.
Body, mind, and...
Mind and
mind, body, soul.
Soul, mind, body, soul.
Okay, yeah. And then you would... So that would form the base of a skill, and then you could spend extra points. But you also had focus, which I thought was a really nice touch. The focus was folk guy, where if you had a couple of points of focus, then say you needed a four and you rolled a three, you could spend a point of focus to bump that three up to a four to give you another success. Which I thought it was a nice little bit of nuance. It wasn't too complicated, and it gave you that, you know, if you don't quite make it, you can just use that. And there was no like downside to using focus. It was just there, you know. So I thought that was good. And the system was like consistent throughout, you know, whether you skill rolls or combat or whatever. And that thing of the target, it looked like a ratio, didn't it? You know, the target colon, the number of successes you need.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, initially you kind of takes you a moment to think about it, but then after you've played a couple of sessions, you don't even need to think about it.
The way it would be written would be like difficulty number 4-3. So that means you need to get roll fours and you need to get three of them.
Yeah.
So that's it. So it's pretty straightforward.
And the Foundry system made that even easier as well, you know, because, you know, a lot of stuff you just click on. I think the talents thing was interesting. Like you say, not too many. I think it's just sometimes working out, you know, how they work. And I remember with the ambidexterity thing and how it interacted with the dual wield thing and so on, and found it took me a little bit to get my head around that. But again, the Foundry system handled a lot of that. I think it perhaps would be a bit more rewarding as a game played around a table, if I'm honest, because as a player, you'd need to dig in a bit more and understand just what's going on there. And again, once you've got it, and you've got it then, but, you know, I mean, it was great. It was fast. You know, we go into a combat. There was, there were moments of drama in there as well. You know, oh my God, bloody hell, I've taken two wounds there. Another one of them, and I'm down, you know, I'm dead. And, you know, and there was definitely moments like that.
Even just against relatively lowly foes like the fire spiders that rent your arm.
I think that was the thing. It was things that might seem fairly trivial, but they might have just an ability is really nasty, you know, or if they do, you know, they gang up on you or whatever. Yeah. I thought overall I was impressed by the system.
I think what was good as well is that we talked about a lot of fantasy tropes and a lot of stuff in there that if you don't know the background that are going to surprise you, jump up and go, oh, these bird-headed beastmen are going to be easy to take out, and then they proceed to absolutely smash you.
They did. They were not. They were not those things.
Good.
Yeah. There was that one bit I remember where we were like, I think it was towards the end of the first adventure. We were at the base of the tower, and you know those corridors running around the outside of it, and we came into one room, and there was just like loads of these things. And they could seem to be able to pass through. They weren't blocked by the doors. And you're like, oh, no, this is, you know, and we all start freaking out. I certainly freaking out. Yeah, you know, you know.
Well, they were wraiths, so that's...
I think that's the other thing is it does have a feeling of, I mean, it's probably, I'm sure you get the same thing with Jeroen, because it's not like orc and owlbears and monsters that are known. Every monster, you have got to approach with a bit of caution, you know. Yeah, but great. I thought the system was a real strength for the game. Yeah,
yeah. I really have to echo Neil's point about the threat level and the peril being really well balanced throughout the game. It always felt like we were teetering on the edge of being completely wiped out by the stuff that was thrown at us. That was really good. And the mechanics to help us out when we're in a pinch were really useful. The focus stuff was really good. And Even if it gets really dangerous, you've got the Soulfire to fall back onto.
And but quite like that's got a limited resource, so you can't always rely on it.
So, yeah, it becomes quite an anchor around your neck if you start using it too fast, and then you've got no recourse when you're in real trouble. And you don't really know how bad it's going to get when you're sort of expecting to lose some characters in combat.
And I quite like the mechanic in the game itself. So we talked about the actual dice mechanic as well, but there's like a sort of an overarching mechanic as well. So like fantasy roleplay, so between adventures you have downtime where you can conduct endeavors. So you can do things like, you know, repair your armor or, you know, get more soul fire back or whatever it might be. But also when I talked about these threats, so eventually there's this thing called the doom clock, which starts to tick up. And you can choose, say, oh, should we keep the doom down? Do we use it some of our endeavors? So you've got a limited resource. And you chose at one point, oh, no, we'll let the doom go up. Some of the creatures become tougher the higher the doom is. And I think you found this when you were fighting at some of the cornate creatures as well. So you got quite a nice sense of overarching threat beyond just the combat itself.
There's just one last thing that I thought took it away from a tabletop game, which is the zones. Because the battle system used zones, it doesn't become about measuring stuff on the table with the ruler, and I thought that was really useful. It's popular in a couple of games at the moment, and I think it's a really good shortcut to making combat systems work faster.
Well, I like zones. I still like the way it worked in this as well, which is pretty good. And the foundry system lets you link, so some zones can be damaging. So, and you can actually make the zones. I didn't ever get that far, but you can do it. So you can say set up a zone. So when you walk into it, it does damage the characters automatically, but that's a level of automation I couldn't ever bother to get to. So in terms of system, are there any thoughts about things like Even Better Ifs or things that you thought, actually, I don't like that very much? Or
I thought it was pretty good. Honestly, I played other systems where there's always been something that niggles me. I don't really think there was with this. I think part of that being the fast-moving nature of it, you just move on. You know?
Move on to the next bit, Move on to the next bit of fun when we're at the rules. Yeah. The only bit that I sort of struggled with, so when we set your characters up, if you remember, we set short-term goals and long-term goals.
Yeah.
So the whole idea about the experience system, it's supposed to be based on achieving goals, okay? And I just thought, this is really unwieldy. So I just defaulted to just have some experience points. Because you were doing stuff when you were going along and thought, I don't know. I think it just...
They have the same in Woofrup, and I find the whole short-term, long-term goal setting really impossible for a lot of players. It's management speak, as far as I can see, and it's just not something that fits into most game sessions.
Yeah.
Unless you're a heavy involved role player and really get into character or something, there's just no way that most people are going to achieve.
Yeah,
but goal.
It puts pressure on the GM then to do something to, you know, if it's, I suppose particularly if you're running a published module, unless you sit down and, you know, have a personal review session with the characters around, you know, well, let's set some objectives. What are your objectives for this quarter?
What's the biggest risk to us if we employ you in the soul fighting?
Yeah, you know, and. And I think that is really hard, and because there've been other games where we've played where they have had those kind of, you know, object. The one that sticks in my mind is Spire, and I think the other one, Heart, the similar thing where you get you've got things that you need to tick off, and so it always means the GM is having to think, you know, they've got. Yeah, you know, four or five.
How do I give you opportunities to tick your boxes?
Yeah, exactly. And I think Spire was perhaps a bit more, players could do more to kind of create those opportunities. But in anything published, if you've got player objectives, unless they're tied in, maybe you've got pre-gens or something like that.
Mm.
But otherwise, I'm not really a fan of them. I don't know.
I think you have to be pretty established in the world or the character in the setting to be able to even set the goals. So if you're fresh off in a starter set, there's absolutely no way you can know what the goals might be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I just thought, just giving you got basically, it was a bit of a halfway house between like milestone stuff. Like, so I said, we finished a session. I reckon that's about 5 experience. That's enough to have a play with. Off you go. And then we moved on to the next. And I just thought, So I just feel like it's a bit of a bit of a bolt on that didn't really work for me. But that's more GM side of things. So, but yeah, I think the system itself is great. I really liked it. And I think, you know, Cubicle 7, with all the hoo-ha about the OGL and D&D, I think they're looking to turn this system into their house, like their generic system as well, which would make a lot of sense, because I think it's Easter access. It does simple to use. It's got lots of enough flavor to it to make it interesting, but it's not, as you say, it's not initially, you know, people coming over from Age of Sigmar, straightforward. So yeah, I'd be interested to see what they do with that. So I suppose when we've been going on for an hour, as we do, it's a roundup really. So is it something that you'd want to play again at some point, or is it something you think you might ever run, either as a system by itself or as in sort of the world of the Soulbound?
I don't think I'd run the setting, because I'm not invested enough in it, and I don't really have any inclination to put the time into it. But I think if they came up with it, an interesting, like the system again in a setting that interested me, you know, or I was going to say a generic fantasy game, but like the world needs another generic fantasy game. Like,
you can never have enough generic systems.
Yeah, you know,
you have to put loads of work into to come up with a background for.
But you know, I think I could definitely be tempted, because you know the system did all the things that I like to have in my games as a GM. Made a lot of sense. It was very consistent. It was fast. You know, there was a lot of variety in there. So I could see myself running it. Depends what Cubicle 7 do with it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't run a game since 1989.
Now's the time.
Now is the time. I mean, I would like to get into doing it again. And it was one of the games that I thought that I might like to play, precisely because I'm quite familiar with the lore, which I think is quite important if you're going to run it, like you know, Neil said. But it was interesting to watch how you were explaining things to Neil and the others when you know you were talking about stuff that I know about, and how would you communicate this probably quite complicated deep lore to someone that knew nothing at all about it. So It's a masterclass in how to.
Well, I don't know. It depends how much of it actually stuck. It really. I mean, Neil goes, whatever. Point me towards the next thing to hit.
Yeah, definitely like to play it again. But I'd really like to explore, you know, slightly different ways of playing it. So we've done the sort of the combat heavy thing. Let's try and do, you know, an investigation thing, an exploration thing. Let's just see how the game works in those contexts. And but yeah, I'd definitely play again.
I'd love to play it again. Running it, I think I'm too encumbered with the rest of Cubicle 7's output for the Wuffrup system. They keep putting out new amazing stuff all the time.
There's enough there to keep you going.
Yeah.
And I'm
still on The Enemy Within. I'm finishing the last chapter and a half of The Enemy Within. So, but yeah, I did like the way the system works. I'd definitely consider it if I was in the search for a fantasy game, but it's not really the main focus for me at the moment.
I really liked it. I was very happy. I've got everything they put out for it, and I think there's a lot of that's often the case. There's a lot of breadth to the world. So you guys are all playing sort of champions of order, but they're also champions of death. So you can have like play vampires, and not angsty, pretty sure vampires, but bite your face off vampires, and all the other various horrible beasties that sort of you know, exist in that world, and also destruction. So you could play orcs, trolls, all that, and with all the ridiculousness that goes with that. And they're going to bring out champions of chaos, so you can play chaos warriors as well. So there's a lot, but that's the sort of high fantasy stuff. I think there's a lot of potential there. If I was going to run it again, I think I would do it as low powered. So I would say, actually, no one is, you're not in a soul binder. You're just, you know, maybe the City Watch, which is a really pretty classic fantasy role play type thing, but City Watching one of the cities. From investigating. So the Stormcast Eternals are doing their things up here. You know, you see the Soulbound, you know, the Soulbound sort of doing their stuff, and you're there trying to fight a bunch of Skaven in the sewers or something awful. And I think the system would scale pretty well to that. So having one or two talents, you'd be amazing. So I think it's one that's back on the rotation. Forbidden Lands, and you know, because there's quite a few others back in the rotation. But I'd certainly want to revisit it. I think it's well worth the Soulbound set. Is a great starting point. You've got enough in there to keep you going. Plenty. There's months and months and months of playtime in that. Okay. All right. Soulbound gets a thumbs up from us. Thanks very much for taking part in the recording, and I'll see you guys soon. Take care, everybody. Thanks very much.
All right.
Cheers.
Bye bye. Thanks for listening to another exploration of my gaming vexes. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to add to what you've heard here, or a gaming vex of your own you'd like to offer up for discussion, you can get in touch with me on Blue Sky via at orlanth.bsky.social or via Discord as orlanth.vex. Until next time, may all of your games be free of vexatiousness and be excellent to each other always.